So I first met Gary Steingart back in, I guess, 2016, when he was writing a story for The New Yorker that ended up being titled Confessions of a Watch Geek. Now, the subheadline for that article was My Year of Getting Deep into Perlage, Three-Quarter Plates, and Micro-Rotors. He may not have always been a watch geek, but he was now firmly in the deep end. He's a wickedly funny guy. He's got a great taste for the finer things in life, even beyond watches. And he's an absolute pleasure to talk to. A few weeks ago, our editor-in-chief, Jack Forrester, and I were lucky enough to sit down with Gary, and we got to pick his brain on a few topics. This included his forthcoming novel, Things He Loves and Laments in Modern Watchmaking, and even his hobby of home tanning watch straps on the porch of his upstate home. We had a great time, and I think you'll be able to hear that, so I hope you enjoyed it half as much as we did. I'm your host, Stephen Pulvarant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week's episode is brought to you by Tudor. Stay tuned later in the show for a look at the Heritage Black Bay Chrono, a new take on one of Tudor's most iconic watches. You can also learn more at TudorWatch.com. I'm here with our illustrious editor-in-chief, Jack Forrester.
Hi, everybody.
And our guest this week, Mr. Gary Steingart, noted author, watch collector, and strap tanner, I think?
Yep. I am a strap tanner. Strap farmer, we say now.
Strap farmer. Yes. Okay. In upstate New York, right?
Yes, in upstate New York. We're in an economically distressed area, so I tan straps.
I hope you get a tax break for that.
Of course. I do actually have a corporation.
Do you?
Yes, like most writers, have a corpse.
The
strap tanning is just an extra bonus.
Is it a shell corporation?
It's a shell corporation.
Okay, yeah. Perfect.
In the Caymans, of course.
Are we at the right point of the conversation to talk about locavora strap tanning?
Yes. Right. It's strapped to wrist instead of farm to table.
But, okay.
We're very proud of our strap tanning.
But it actually is a thing you do.
Yep. Yes. So, you know, as I've said many times before, I'm really bored in the country. There's not much to do. So I lay out straps and let the sun grill them and then let the fog come in the morning. I invite you both to my illustrious abode if you want to see this in action. This summer, I'm also learning to make good Gibsons. So this is a twofer.
This sounds like a field trip.
This is a field trip.
Yeah. Artisanally, one at a time, hand tan straps and the perfect Gibson.
Yes,
I'm in.
This is what I'm offering
too.
You.
Yeah. All right, cool. We'll have to find somebody else to run the site for the day, but it'll be fine.
We're also lousy with poets, so a poet will come and declaim to you at some point, and that's
amazing.
Right? Wow, how about that?
Can we get something in dead languages?
Yeah, of course.
Now, does the fog roll in reliably every day? Pretty much.
It's a pretty good fog. It's the Mid Hudson Valley. There's a river nearby. I don't understand how anything works. And by the way, it's not a river. It's not a river. It's an estuary, whatever the hell that is. So the estuary, I think, produces a lot of moisture because we're near it. And then the moisture falls upon the strap and gives it a kind of really luscious quality and almost a kind of sweet smell, I think. Which mixed with just the right amount of human sweat is spectacular.
We might have to get the Hodinkee shop folks in on this.
I have to admit, it's probably fortunate that no one's ever asked me, but I don't know exactly what an estuary is.
I think an estuary, this is Professor Gary time. I believe an estuary, you know, a river flows in one direction, an estuary can flow in both directions.
Huh. So it's a tidal estuary. In every case, is an estuary tidal?
Yes. Sure. Of course, every estuary is tidal, duh.
All right. So bring things back to something Jack actually does know something about. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about watches for a minute, okay. Regardless of what the readers or listeners, I guess, in this case, may or may not have expected here. But
pretty much they were all here for the estuary.
I think so. I mean, that's why I'm here. But
Yeah.
Gary, we met you, I guess, like a year and a half ago now when you were working on a story for The New Yorker.
How long ago was it? It came out February or March 2017.
Okay.
So I must have researched it in 2016. So yeah, probably yeah. 2 years
so
ago.
So 2 years ago. And you were researching this piece for The New Yorker, which I think probably almost everyone listening to this has read. If not, we will link up to it in the show notes so everybody can check it out. Our own Jack is featured in the story as well.
I mentioned en passant, as it were.
En passant, but it's a great quote about collectors.
It's an amazing quote.
Yeah, it's really spectacular.
But was that kind of the beginning of your watch collecting journey, or did it start before that?
It started right before that, as the election of 2016 was hitting its stride, and I had an uncomfortable feeling in my gut. I'm from a pretty screwed up part of the world, Russia originally, so I kind of have the way older people can sense rain coming, I can sense bad things are coming.
You felt Trump in your bones?
I felt him in my bones. And I actually grew up, when I came to America, we lived in Queens, and we would walk up to the Trump estate and lovingly peer through the gates that he was our hero. As a Soviet immigrant, he represented money, and just about bad money, yeah. and hair. We had a paucity of money and hair, two things that Russia is not famous for. So he was very important. So anyway, as the election wore on, I kind of really needed to take my mind off things, and I became obsessed with watches. And I bought my first watch, a Max Bill at MoMA.
It's a pretty good place to start.
It's the entry point. I think you've mentioned in one of your articles, Stephen, that it's a pretty decent entry point into watches. And I still have mine and wear it on occasion. I think
totally.
When I need to feel really mid-century, as one does every once in a while. I know you do.
I feel like that often.
You feel like that often?
Yeah, very often.
I am often feeling very mid-century myself. Because I really missed the 20th century. It really had its moments.
Yeah, I didn't think it was possible, but we have managed to make mid-20th century seem like an aspirational time.
I know. It really, it was the best. Europe lay in ruins and all that, but whatevs. things were good. And so anyway, so the Max Bill led to Nomos, and then I floated into, Rolex, especially 60s Rolex, and Lange. I mean, it just went on and on. And
can I ask you, Gary, what was it about the Max Bill specifically that caught your eye?
Well, it really kind of, for me, redefined what I thought about watches. Because I grew up really, you have that very famous article about the gold day date and how much that meant to you growing up, because you saw your uncle, I believe, right, who was an ambassador, wearing it. So when I was growing up, yes, the yellow gold day date also meant a lot for me. But then, I went to the Oberlin Institute for Exceptional People, where, you couldn't even aspire to a yellow gold day date, much less own one.
And they probably would have drummed you out of the Oberlin Institute for Exceptional
People. Yes. Well, that's if you were one of those, you better be like really glam and addicted to many different kinds of heroin.
They would have stripped your exceptionality from you in public and run you out of town on a road.
Yeah, they would have. What did they do with Dreyfus? They broke his sword. They would have broken my hacky sack over their knee, and drummed me out of Oberlin. But the other thing I also knew, I grew up with a Casio musical watch, which, because I didn't know English, was my best friend growing up. It sang like 12 different melodies from around the world, including Kalinka Malinka, a Russian song about boysenberries or gooseberries. Anyway, so I loved that watch. But in my mind, it was either an electronic Casio or a yellow gold day date. And the Max Bill was this completely unexpected category. It felt like a really thoughtful, beautifully designed piece. I remember thinking, oh my God, $1,000? How can anyone afford this? 2 years later, kill me.
I think that's a familiar feeling for a lot of the people listening.
And I went back to my wife and I was like, I'm going to make this huge purchase. I hope you don't mind. And she said, no, treat yourself. little knowing.
Little did she know.
Little did she know where this would end up.
That's it. That's the thin end of the wedge.
So anyway, that was the beginning for me. But the Bauhausian aspect of watches, the whole form follows function, was a really, really big kind of very important thing for me, because I felt like these are objects that look beautiful on my wrist, but don't bespeak or don't, they're not about my saying, hey, look at me, I have a watch. Almost all the watches I have are completely unnoticeable except by the select few of us that are similarly situated.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because, sort of picking a watch that is specifically not just unostentatious, but actually anti-ostentatious. That's an interesting
thing. Yeah. Well, some watches, like I own a GMT, which is 1675, which is larger. So and because my wrist is so dainty, it actually, I mean, part of it is matching it to your wrist. There's a,
right.
So for the last couple of years, I've been researching hedge funds. And I've been hanging out with a lot of hedge funders, mostly men. And sort of, so some of the ones who are, you know, have their own funds, et cetera, don't really have a watch at all because, you know, time works for them. They don't need to really know time. Time, if they say stop, time will stop. Everyone freezes, you know. But for some of the people who are, you know, traders or somewhere in the middle rungs of it, often you'll see that the watch is, you know, a size or two, according to my sensibilities, too large for that specific wrist.
Right.
So that became something very interesting to notice. And also on the trading floors of banks, et cetera, there's always, they're big, monstrous, big, I shouldn't say monstrous, some of them are quite lovely, but pieces larger than the wrist it was meant for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the display aspect of luxury watches is, well, I shouldn't say the display aspect, but the signaling aspect is important, isn't it? Whether, irrespective of what you're signaling.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I have a friend from Singapore, and he says, you know, that, and Singapore has all these watch publications that seems to be watch obsessed. And he says, look, in Singapore, you know, cars are super expensive. There's a tariff of, I don't know, 200% or something. There's no place to park them. It's a small city state.
And so, you don't actually own them either.
And you don't actually own them. And he says, you know, so he says watches are the way that you signal anything in Singapore. And sometimes I look at these slides of watches in Singapore and it'll be, you know, some secretary's wearing a Nautilus or something. So it's the way you signal things in other parts of Asia, I think, as well.
Yeah, Singapore is an interesting case. There's been a lot of wealth creation there and there is, you know, has been and is a lot of affluence.
Yeah.
And just the sort of economic pressures that, you know, militate against the usual forms of social signaling of wealth there, it kind of is a natural breeding ground for an obsession with watches.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And I go to Korea quite a bit and also something similar, not quite to that extent, but a very similar obsession with watches. And Russia, where I'm from, is known, of course, for Vladimir Putin as president, who has a very impressive watch collection.
He does.
And actually, I have to say, although, you know, I often think of his regime as tasteless to the core, his watches aren't so bad. You know, he had a nice F.P. Journe.
We used to love giving Louis, former Houdinki team member, now a team member over at Breitling, yeah, a hard time because he used to have the same Blancpain that Mr. Putin owned, and we used to give him quite a hard time when he would wear his Putin watch to the office.
That was pretty hilarious because they certainly did not share political views.
Or about anything else.
Anything else, yeah.
Shout out to Louis.
Shout out to Louis. It's funny because I always, Breguet is sort of the brand that I often associate with Russia because a Pushkin poem, which I can't remember by heart, but quotes, mentions Breguet, something like a dandy is standing on Nevsky Prospect, the main street in St. Petersburg, looking at his Breguet. So okay. Dandy and Breguet, in my mind, were always kind of affiliated.
And historically, of course, some of Breguet's most important clients were Russian or in the East, in any event.
Yeah, for sure.
So do you find yourself, I mean, you mentioned you were doing research for your most recent book, but do you find yourself now as a writer, as part of your kind of observations of people, looking at people's wrists?
Very much so, very much so. And you know, so for, you know, for this book that's coming out, like I said, I spent 3 years researching hedge funds, but I also spent part of that time, because this is a separate narrative strand in the novel, I spent a lot of that time on a Greyhound bus going across the country. I know, two things that don't really belong together. And it was really funny to see how often a watch that would be original, worn by some hedge funder, would show up as a fake on the arm of somebody on that Greyhound.
Interesting.
But the same kind of idea, signaling, except within one's means.
Right.
Interesting.
So this was the Greyhound bus travels cross country. This was in the service of doing research for an upcoming novel of yours.
No, the same novel. I know. The same novel contains both a hedge funder and a Greyhound trip across the country.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about this novel? I know you can't say too much right now.
Well,
but
I mean, I'll say one thing is that the narrator, who is, you know, he flees his wife. He flees. He has a disabled child, and you know, because he's kind of a jackass, he flees. and also his fund is falling apart. Is being investigated by the SEC. All the yummy stuff. So he gets on a Greyhound and he tries to recreate this romantic journey. But watches are the way that he deals with the world. He can't communicate really with people except he thinks of himself as this friendly guy, but inside he's socially very anxious. And the one way he can communicate with others is, you know, through talking about, you know, an F.P. Journe or and overseas, and that's I doubt we have any listeners like that at all. But but also, you know, I mean, I also find this is the first hobby, quote unquote, that I've ever had, and it's funny because this is a kind of, especially talking to, you know, talking to people I haven't met, the fact that everyone can just easily slide into talking about the esoterica of this very small hobby is yeah. fascinating. You know, you meet somebody, if you meet somebody and they have a watch on and they know about watches, then you can probably survive like a 14-hour flight.
Yeah. Have you found through your becoming obsessed and it playing a part in this novel, have you found yourself talking to non-watch people about watches a lot?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, so I just did a kind of preview reading in Seattle for the book. So I read a chapter from the book, and lo and behold, watches came up. And it was this really stupid conversation about F.P. Jordan versus Rolex. I don't know where this came up, because it's not even a subject of conversation, but these two guys were arguing about which is better, two hedge fund guys. And one was saying, you know, but everyone knows what a Rolex is, it's a status thing. And the other was saying, you know, but an F.P. Jordan is well-crafted, look at the, you know, look at the movement, et cetera. And so this, and so I'm reading this to 400 people who are not watch people, and I'm thinking, oh, Jesus, when, I'm pretty good at, you know, figuring out when people are tuning out. And they kind of, they survived it. You know, they survived a couple of minutes of watches. But now I'm being invited to speak about watches solely. So I did a conversation about watches in Chicago.
Right.
At the Alliance Française. And it was spectacular. It was 150 people, which I, you know, just watches, no literature, just, which I'm known for more for literature, of course. But 150 watch nerds came out. Some of them wanted me to sign their straps. I mean, it was really kind of
a homecoming. You're kind of a big deal.
No, I probably not, but it was just lovely to, and I found myself loving talking about watches for an hour and a half. I was interviewed by a local watch person. The honorary consul of Switzerland to Chicago came. It was quite an event.
Yeah. Talking about watches all day is not a bad way to spend one's day, is it, Jack?
It's not a terrible way to spend your day.
No, it's certainly not.
But in the time that you've been in this, you know, at one time very idiosyncratic and very small scale relative to where it is now, hobby. I mean, in the time that you've been interested in watches, have you perceived any change in the breadth of audience?
It's expensive.
Oh, well, yeah. Who's that?
You know, so I mean, I made the terrible mistake of falling in love with 1960s vintage Rolex sports models. Luckily, I avoided Daytona fever. And there's a reason for that. And my bank account is thanking me endlessly, as is my child, who can now go to college. I'm not a great driver. I just learned to drive a couple of years ago. And I really feel that things I'm not good at, I should not sort of... I don't want watches that are not a part of my aesthetic or a part of what I love, you know? And I feel that, you know, like bad drivers should have their Daytonas taken away because it's so much affiliated with driving. So as much as I love certain Daytonas as well, and I love pre-Daytonas quite a bit, but that never quite gelled with me. But unfortunately, I did fall in love with Explorers and GMTs.
But you know, Gary, like lots of people fall in love with and wear watches from worlds that they'll never experience and that are not particularly, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. this is sort of, you know, almost apocryphal at this point. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, very few people who wear dive watches yeah. actually dive. You know, very few people who wear, you know, Speedmasters, you know.
go to space.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I'm with you, though. Like, I just got my driver's license, I guess, just under 2 months ago.
Oh, wow.
Finally.
Wow.
My wife is very happy. But I'm with you. Like the Daytona, I can appreciate it as an aesthetic object, but kind of as a romantic object. It doesn't speak to me in that way. Whereas something like an Explorer or a GMT really feels much more me. It feels like it makes a lot more sense for me.
It's very true. You know, I love desk divers. I think that's what they're called, right? I mean, yeah. I think it's great. It's great to aspire to things. You know, I mean, I guess I come from a society, you know, Soviet Union, Russia, where you don't aspire to things, where you are, you know who you are, and that's the limits. There's no Walter Mitty moment, you know?
Right.
And I love the Speedmaster because it went to space. Good Lord. I mean, is anything cooler than that? Also, Russians have a version of that, Sturminsky watch.
Sturminsky, yeah.
So, of course, I love that stuff. I swim quite a bit, so I buy watches that are perfect for swimming, you know? But
do you wear a watch when you swim?
Yeah, I do, because I swim an ungodly amount of time. I could swim like 2 hours a day, and I need to know when to get out. So I wear, there's two watches I wear, a Tudor Black Bay 36 and a Nomos Neomatic Club, both of which I love. Very different watches, obviously.
Yeah.
But the bezel for me is a bit extraneous because I know I'm not going to use it for anything. And so even though some, I mean, of course, some old subs are amazing, but it's just not for me.
Interesting.
That's an interesting couple of watches to wear while swimming. I would have thought, you know, I mean, the Tudor's kind of an obvious one, but I wouldn't have thought a Nomos would be something you'd want to spend 2 hours in the water with.
No, it's great. I mean, this one has
nothing against Nomos.
Light blue and light orange accents. Mm-hmm. So it's perfect for the winter because in the summer I swim in an outdoor pool and you know everything looks beautiful. But in the winter, of course, I go to a gym and I swim in a pool and you put that thing on, you feel like you're in LA. You know, there's like there's the hope of LA that you walk out and you know the winter will not confront you. So I do love that watch. I think it's a beautiful. Kind of really an all-arounder kind of watch.
So you kind of started out with finding the sort of Bauhaus form follows function aesthetic. That was the thing that kind of drew you to it. And I mean, with mid-1960s Rolexes, there's the same kind of vibe, although it's expressed in a different way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the person that really motivated me was William Gibson, who is one of my favorite writers ever. I used to read his kids, Isaac Asimov Science Fiction magazine incessantly. And William Gibson was in practically every issue.
Jeez, I remember reading him back in the 80s when he was publishing stuff in Omni. You know.
Yeah, oh yeah, of course, Omni. I mean, he was...
Long gone.
Yeah. And he's, you know, and we're Twitter friends and we're just, you know, I just love that guy. I can't wait to finally meet him someday. But he wrote of the Rolex Explorer 1, he said, he regards it as the peak of Swiss stainless steel mechanical sports watch design. He said this in an interview, and I kept it on my phone, and I just, the moment I read that, I was like, yes, that's it. So the Explorer 1, the 1016 specifically, became like a graily watch for me, and I really wanted to find the perfect one. He's also not immune to the charms of the Mark 11.
Mm-hmm. And
he loves Oris divers. So pretty, all in all, really great taste.
Yeah.
But the big thing from him, the sort of like big essay that I remember is, what was the title? The Tamagotchi Effect?
Yeah, about eBay. Yeah, about his hunting on eBay. Yeah, I read that as well and that was, I think, the first time I heard of eBay. I'm a little technologically behind always. But he's, you know, the way I think he has mentioned form follows function in other essays and, you know, just and then I saw one on the internet. I was like, "Holy cow! This is what I want." You know,
and you made it happen.
I made it happen very recently. Yeah. I've been hunting for a while through my good friend Eric Wind of Wind Vintage. Finally, unearthed one for me, and I mean, it's a keeper. It'll be very hard to get rid of this, and it's got everything I want: the exclamation mark, mm-hmm. the chapter ring, nice end links. I think 1963. It's just a very, very nice watch.
Yeah. For those of you who can't see into the studio, which is all of you, Gary and I are currently passing our 1016s across the table to one another very precariously.
Oh, my God.
I remember your... Wow, is beautiful.
They're twins. Almost.
They are twins.
That is insane.
We'll have to do some serial number checking after this. But
holy cow.
Stephen, what year is yours?
I believe mine's a little earlier. Mine, I think, is more like 61, 62. 62,
yeah.
But, mm-hmm. Finding a good watch is not easy. And people assume often, you know, people come to us and say, oh, can you help me find this? Can you help me find that? But it's the supply of good watches is shrinking, I think. Yeah. Or maybe the demand has just gone up so quickly. Finding a good example of something is getting harder, especially if you're not willing to pay absolutely any price.
Well, this is what happened to me. I mean, you know, Jack, you earlier said, you know, what did you notice in the 2 years or so that you've been doing this? And I think what I've noticed is that, unfortunately, the watches that I dearly loved, I wasn't the only one. And there were two watches specifically, and that was the 1675 and the 1016, which are both sort of my Rolex grails. So I was not the only one that fell in love with 1960s Rolex sports watches, and I paid dearly for it. It was obscene, you know. It just kept going up, and I was telling Eric and others, you know, please just find it now because each month is costing me.
Literally month by month.
Month by month.
And it's that crazy effect where you see 100 of them, mm-hmm. and then the moment you decide, maybe I'm ready to pull the trigger, like I'll start seriously looking, the supply dries up like that, and they're just gone. And you don't see a single one for months.
But, you know, I mean, often I think it's absolutely crazy. You know, I love all these watches. But, you know, you look at something like the 1675, right? It costs more than double, way more than double than one of my favorite Patek watches, the 3445, which has a movement. I always forget the number, 2780. But it is an insane movement. The gold rotor, the everything about it is groundbreaking, really. And it costs less than half than what an Explorer at this point probably would cost. So
yeah.
You do start to wonder the supply and demand, the bubble aspect of this.
And now we'll look at this week's sponsor. Over the last few years, Tudor's Black Bay line has been the gold standard for watches that combine a respect for watchmaking history with modern craftsmanship. The Black Bay Chrono adds an additional complication to the Black Bay family, but all built on the foundation of the iconic snowflake-style hands and the sturdy Black Bay profile. Inside beats the manufacturer caliber MT5813, a column-wheel chronograph movement which is chronometer-certified and fitted with a silicon hairspring. The Tudor Black Bay Chrono is bold and modern, but with just the right dose of nostalgia. Visit your local authorized retailer to see these watches in the metal, or TudorWatch.com to learn more. Let's get back to the show. And so you mentioned that a Patek is one of your favorite references as well. So, you know, again, Jack referenced it a minute ago, but your taste kind of started in this sort of like Bauhaus area and expanded into Rolex and then expanded from there. Where have you continued to kind of find excitement in the watch world?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I'm always looking for what's the best. And Jack talked about, I think during one episode of Friday Live, you talked about, yes.
R.I.P. Friday Live.
Right. So at one point, Jack talked about, you guys had a sort of talk about, you know, movement versus design, and design, of course, but movements are important to me. I mean, this is a mechanical object. Otherwise, I would just buy, you know, jewelry.
Right.
I guess they're just, you know, and I've thought about this a lot. I mean, movements are inherently harder because, first of all, there's a much steeper learning curve, or maybe not steeper necessarily, but different. Right? Mm-hmm. A different learning curve than, focusing on the minutiae of what distinguishes the exterior aesthetics of one watch from another. And of course, you can't see them.
You can't see them. You know. Well, now, of course, because of case backs, you can, but in the olden days, obviously, you can do a Goldberger movement and use your cheese knife to pry one open. But so for example, Speedmasters are unfortunately too big for me. But one watch that I'm really interested in is the Seamasters that came with the 321 movement, such as I think is beloved by Roger Smith. That's an insane movement, obviously. And you can still find one. There's a reference I'm kind of looking for, the 2451. I think it's the 2451, which is very early Seamaster Chrono, which is, by the way, beautiful and very hard to find in good condition. Later ones are ubiquitous, but the early ones are hard to find.
But that's an interesting situation where if you're buying for the movement, you're much, much better served by looking at the Seamaster instead of the Speedmaster.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's true of a lot of things. You know, I mean, some of the Explorer movements are some of the best ever made. And Smith, when you interviewed him, was talking about how his daily beater is, an 11-4270 or one of those very late 36-millimeter, I think the last 36-millimeter Explorer. So, yeah, no, I love that part. You guys had an article, I think it was Jason Heaton who met a guy who only has one watch. Can you imagine? And it was a shocking article. I mean, I think it really... but it was a great watch, and he had spent his whole life with it. He bought it in Zaire during the Ali Foreman fight, the Rumble in the Jungle.
Yeah, I remember this.
And it lasted, like, it's been going strong for all those years and is a testament to the interesting life that he's led. So sometimes I think, you know...
What do you think about that, the sort of romance? This is like an aspirational fantasy for us in a certain way, like the fantasy of, like, one guy, one watch, your whole life, that's it.
So it would be very hard to do just one watch. I often end up in scenarios where wearing, like, a nice, you know, Rolex would probably not be a good idea. So it would be a two-watch scenario at least.
Right.
But let's say it was one watch, something like the 11-4270, something I could put a lot of dings on that's pretty much, you know, a tank, but not shaped like a tank like some contemporary Rolex models. Yeah. That would be really, really a wonderful way to go. You can buy one for about, I think, $8,000-$10,000. You can buy one that's never been used, so the gaskets are probably still intact, so you can swim in it, I would hope. I think about that. You know, what would it be like? My life is, you know, it's not, I don't rumble in the jungle all the time, but it's been fairly interesting. interesting. Not I travel all the time. A lot. You know, I travel a lot. I eat a lot of beef. It's an interesting life. You know,
you write some stuff occasionally.
Yeah, right. So I think about that, and then honestly, a lot of the current watches kind of leave me a little underwhelmed. This whole Fotina thing has been weighing on me philosophically.
Oh, do tell.
Well, there's a term that Vladimir Nabokov, author of Lolita and many books not about statutory rape, there's a Russian term he used, Porschlist, which is a kind of vulgar imitation. Very hard. It doesn't really exist. No real direct translation, but it's a kind of vulgar imitation.
What's the word again?
Porschlist. P-O-S-H-L-O-S-T. I think it's how you would spell it in English. You know, and it could be of a sentimental nature. It could be kind of something unearned also, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when I see that kind of Fotina, I, and there's some of these watches are gorgeous. You know, the Longines, is it the military? Some new watch that came out that has the dots on it.
Oh, yeah.
These, you know, computer aid design dots or whatever the heck. You
They're like aging each dial.
They're
separately.
Aging each dial, you know. I could just hear someone in Switzerland go, let's turn the nostalgia to 11, you know. but I think it's a gorgeous watch, you know, and if that watch was real, I mean, it was an actual watch, then I'd be all over it.
I mean, we're in this funny situation now where the demand for nostalgia has outstripped the supply of actual sources of nostalgia.
Exactly. But when it comes to vintage
watches, limited resource.
Nostalgia is all. We reach peak nostalgia. But nostalgia also brings this kind of what to my mind is like the Blade Runner effect, which is, remember that scene where Rachel, who is a replicant, talks to Deckard, the Harrison Ford character, who's the Blade Runner, and she says something like, I'm real, you know, and he says, I have memories. And Deckard says, those aren't memories, those are implants. That's Tyrell's niece's memory. Those are Tyrell's niece's memory. Right. Tyrell is the maker of the replicants, you know. And so often when I buy a watch like this one, which is gorgeous, and, you know, I think, am I sort of being a replicant, am I getting someone else's memories?
Right.
And I mean, to a certain extent, the answer is yes.
To a large extent, yeah. I think the answer is yes. Yeah. I mean, I still prefer being a replicant to Porschlist, Nabokov's vulgarity, right. But it's a question of...
There's got to be a middle ground in
there. There's got to be a middle ground.
Yeah. I wonder, I've had conversations with a handful of folks in the industry, in the watch industry, mm-hmm. Usually on the design side, and I've heard more than one or two of them talk about this impending crisis they see on the mm-hmm. horizon, which is... The current trend in watches is all about nostalgia. Mm-hmm. It's all ideas from 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah.
What is going to happen when that disappears, when inevitably fashion cycles
right.
and people are looking for something genuinely new?
Right.
We've created a whole generation of watch designers, watch collectors, watch business folks
yeah.
who only know how to create and sell nostalgia.
Yeah, you know,
where
me,
will the new ideas come from?
I mean, to me, the interesting thing about that is like you can view this as a sort of excessive resorting to vintage cues, mm-hmm. or you can view it as a return to classicism that the watch industry unwisely abandoned in the exuberance of the 2000s.
Sure. But I think there are independent brands that are trying to do something interesting. There's a micro brand. I never thought I'd like a micro brand, but when I was in Chicago, this guy Chase came from Oak and Oscar.
Yeah.
And the Jackson, I think, was the model, right? And it borrows some cues, and it's based on some race that happened in Chicago 100 years ago. I try to ignore all that part, especially the racing. But I think it really was a very impressive watch, a little too big for me. The thickness is pretty, it's 14.5 millimeters. But I thought it was an exceptionally great way to take just enough from the past and really update it. They had these, they had a 12-hour totalizer, and it was, the registers were, what's that term? It was
called? Oh, they're nested. It's the same register.
Yeah. It's the same register, and it was, I thought that was a very great way to approach the problem. The watch felt entirely new, entirely modern. The thickness felt right. A little too much for me, but in general, I thought it was one of the best sort of ways to negotiate with the past. And to create something new.
Yeah, that's actually a great way to put it, negotiate with the past. And it's extraordinarily hard to do. I mean, on the one hand, we want, that's what we want out of mechanical horology,
yeah.
right? We want a sense of connection yeah. with the past. And we want a sense of direct, tangible connection with the past. But what we don't want is, you know, a kind of slavish imitation of it and a sort of riding on the coattail, excessive riding on the coattails of the past for validation.
Yeah, look, I mean, I teach at Columbia, I teach fiction writing at Columbia, and next to me are the poets, you know, and they, I think poets and watchmakers have a very similar kind of thing because, you know, there's constantly the cry of make it new, and at the same time, you're dealing with an art form that really kind of doesn't fit with contemporary needs.
Yeah.
But you can make it new, and I think with watches as well.
Yeah, I always have this kind of internal struggle myself thinking about, like, quote unquote, I'm doing scare quotes, like modern watchmaking. Modern watchmaking in theory would be electronic watchmaking, right?
That's
like,
right.
Well, in fact, it would be electronic.
Right,
watchmaking.
Right. Good point. There's no
Man,
world. I don't get to make that decision. In no world is there mechanical watchmaking today that isn't in some way nostalgic, right? Like, there's something in it you can do.
The whole enterprise is nostalgic.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I think we all, in being interested in mechanical watchmaking, have made ourselves okay with that, right?
Yeah. And shown ourselves to be pathetically incapable of coping with the modern world.
Well, I think that's part of it. I think in some ways,
partly a joke, but
watch collecting is a kind of FU to the fact that we're digitized 24/7.
Yeah.
And this is our little tiny chance to escape. And I actually, you know, I care about precision, weirdly enough, because I try to use these watches as a way not to look up the time on my phone. This is a little bit of time away from my phone. So in a very nerdish way, I actually time my watches. You know, I don't have that machine. That would be the next step, obviously. But
we can help with that.
Oh, God. Here
we
go.
Yeah, but it's like it's really weird. You know, the whole evolution of timekeeping has... You know, there's this kind of interesting dance between the public and the private aspects of it, and the use of time as control, and the ability to sort of own time and have it be something that you personally own. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like a mechanical watch nowadays, you feel like you're taking back ownership of your time to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. In the same way as I was talking about, you know, hedge fund managers who didn't want to wear a watch at all because they didn't want to know, you know, that they own the time. Most of us can't quite do that. But this is a when I look at a watch, when I wear a watch, I feel like I'm not under anyone's jurisdiction in the same way I am
exactly.
when I pick up my phone, because even though I'm looking at the time, in 3 seconds, I'm answering something from somebody. And that's just not how I want to live my life. I'd originally moved upstate as a way to escape the pull of civilization because the cell phone coverage there is still pretty terrible. It's gotten better, unfortunately, but cell phone and cellular, whatever, the LTE coverage is terrible.
Yeah.
So you often can't communicate, and that's been a huge boon to my writing process. Because...
So do you feel like that's the reason the Apple Watch might bother some people so much? It's like an intrusion into this world that we have specifically retreated to in order to get away from what it represents.
It's interesting. I mean, I think it was Ben who reviewed the watch and said that it actually, I can't remember if it was him or somebody else who said that it actually kind of lessened his interaction with, you know,
that was
world.
Definitely one of his observations.
Right. As opposed to pulling out the phone, that the watch was more humane, so to speak.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think the phone is very inhumane. And I did a piece for The New Yorker a while ago where I was given the first iteration and last iteration of Google Glass. and Google Glass, so that's these are glasses you wear.
Right.
And you, instead of using your phone, you kind of communicate through them. I loved it because it was such an awful design that it kind of lessened my... If you took away my phone and I just had this glass to work with, I would have used it less. And I think maybe the same is true of the watch.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of not... You know, I know that there's all these... A lot of people are scared, and I read the reader's comments and I think you're kind of scared of what's the Apple Watch going to do to all this. I don't know. I kind of don't think it will displace... For this tiny community, the same way people have always said, you know, e-books are going to destroy print, you know, and TV is going to destroy print. And, you know, print muddles along. It's not, you know, novels don't sell more than they ever have in the past, per capita, certainly not. But, you know, this weird group of, you know, book nerds and watch nerds continues to exist. You know, as I tried to sell my wife on it, I said, you know, these aren't objects. It's an investment class. It's an asset class, rather.
I mean, that's
not
true.
I may or may not have berated a table of wedding guests last weekend about how they should be putting their money into vintage Rolex instead of mutual funds. But
I think it's kind of almost bullshit. I just did an article on Bitcoin, you know, for The New Yorker. So I'm into bubbles in a big way. But this, I really don't think I'm going to make a fortune off my 1016. But, you know, that is sort of how I justify it, as well, you're putting money into something that, you know, that's an investment. Not really true.
Right.
But so then if you do start to look at it merely as luxury, then it does become a little hard to get away with it in terms of, especially if you own, as some of us do, more than, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 watches, it becomes a little... A little hard.
Yeah, but it's, you know, Gary, it's weird. Like, what luxury is has, you know, and what luxury is in general and what luxury watchmaking specifically is has changed quite a bit over the last 50 years.
Yeah. No, and like I said, you know, a lot of the watches I love, Nomos, and Explorer, they don't scream luxury at all, but they are, you know. And in some ways, they're the ultimate kind of, you know, it's almost like a screw you to the aspirational classes that I can wear something that you won't even aspire to. That's how cool I am.
Right. It's so understated you won't even realize how expensive it is.
Yeah. And so I end up in these conversations a lot where I'm like, but I really appreciate the beauty and the mechanics of it to such a point. I mean, what do you want me to do? You know, I don't golf. I don't snorkel. I don't, you know,
I don't.
Are those the two other options?
Those are the two other. Well, I don't wear fancy clothes or, you know, expensive. Well, okay. I do wear decent clothes.
I don't know, Gary. That's a pretty flashy t-shirt.
Okay. I've never really spent money on anything. It's always been just low cost index funds. Cause I always think that an artist is, you know, just one bad book away from complete, you know, being completely forgotten.
Let's hope it's not this next one.
Let's hope it's not this next one. Well, this one's got watches. So how can it go wrong? Right? Watches and hedge funds. I mean, who's not going to buy that? Don't answer that. but so for me, this has been, and like I said, this is the first material possession I've ever had. I haven't owned a car until 3 years ago because I live upstate. Now I have to drive. But before that, and I've always traveled on other people's dime for, you know, journalism or whatever. So I've been able to not spend money. and I don't know. I mean, I think sometimes when I think of that exit watch, that idea of, you know, I'm going to have one watch and I'm going to beat the shit out of it, I think a part of that is a kind of, you know, I grew up poor, you know, we were immigrants, we didn't have anything. And the idea of having these watches still feels a little risky to me in some ways.
It feels a little weird.
It feels weird. Yeah, it does. And then, you know, and you read comments and people get very upset. They're like, what the hell happened to this hobby? You know, when I showed up, you could buy a nice Explorer for $3,000 and life was good. And I do feel, and I think William Messina talks about this a lot, and he has a kind of feeling of, you know, where's it all going?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I first got interested in watches in the mid-1990s, there's just no relationship between where prices are now for vintage and where prices were then. I mean, you know, back then vintage was, you know, kind of the quirky, you know, thoughtful choice that you would make, you know, in opposition to the outlandishly greater cost of buying a new watch. And now it's just the other way around.
Yeah.
And also back then they weren't vintage watches. They were old watches.
Yeah.
Or they were just watches.
Or just watches, but it wasn't an aspirational.
Crap.
Yeah. It wasn't an aspirational category.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have a very good watch friend. Well, friend in general, but he also loves watches. Sorry, watch friend is not really a term, right? I have a good friend who loves watches in El Paso, Texas, and which borders Ciudad Juarez, which used to be one of the most violent cities in the world, but it's a city I love dearly. And he scours the pawn shops in those two cities, and the results are insane.
Wow.
I mean, you can find incredible. He finds stuff, I mean, he finds Rolexes from, I don't know, the teens for nothing.
Now, I wonder if we're going to see a giant spike in travel, too.
Don't do
this. This episode brought to you by...
Yeah, the El Paso Travel Tourist Board.
Yeah, it's all right. I would take that.
No, it's a great, great town. And by the way, and a huge chapter in my next book is set in El Paso and Juarez. Uh-huh. So I really took to it. I thought it was a city where it felt real. You know, you live in one of these global cities like New York or LA or London, and nothing feels real. Everything feels like it's a giant bubble. Whereas you go to El Paso and things are incredibly real. There's a drug war across the border. People are trying to make ends meet. And there's completely underpriced watches running around.
I mean, that's as real as real gets, right, Jack?
Let's go there now.
Yeah.
Let's do the next episode.
Live.
Oh, and the food. Oh, my God, of course.
The I'm actually from Texas. I don't know if we've talked about this before.
Really?
But, yeah, I've been to El Paso before, and the food is insane.
It's insane.
It's really incredible. Insane.
Oh, my God. And if you're – I think it's the level of crime has gone down enough. It used to be, you know, like 400 people killed a year or something. But the level in Juarez is down enough. Not in El Paso. El Paso is incredibly safe. Juarez. But on my last visits there, it felt pretty safe. And the food there is even better somehow.
Yeah.
And it's just across, it's just one bridge across from EPT. Yeah.
I love this idea you brought up a minute ago, though, of, you know, the more people get in, the more people who get into watches, the more the kind of old guard, you know, decry the end of this hobby and how it's all ending and how nothing's like it used to be. But to a certain extent, isn't that the point, to get more people into this or to make the community more active? I mean, I'm sure back then it was, oh, nobody cares about these things. They're so underappreciated. If only there was more money devoted to scholarship and to
I have to say, as an older watch writer who's getting crabbier by the year, I take a great deal of pleasure in finding more and more to decry because, you know, it keeps the pen wet.
It also keeps the pages dinky full.
No, your decrying is beautiful. It's
oh, well, thank you.
It's beautiful decrying. but, you know, the thing is, you know, so how many people were alive on this planet in the last 100 years? I'm not good at math, but 10 billion? I don't know. A lot. A lot
is a safe bet.
A lot is a safe bet, and maybe between a third and a half of them owned watches. I know, of course, many parts of the world people didn't. So there's probably gazillions of watches running around, and so there's always kind of a new opportunity. You're always finding something incredibly new and weird.
Yeah.
That is the thing. I mean, you know, we're focused if we think about the things that are making people decry the state of modern watch collecting, it's really a relatively small slice of the entire history of watchmaking.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I was very appreciative that both you guys, when you reviewed the Christie's and Sotheby's, I think, over the Geneva sales, and you listed like 10, 12 watches, and only one of them, I think, was a Rolex, and the rest weren't. And I thought that was, you know, and as I talk about, you know, sports Rolex from the 60s a lot. People can't shut me up, but I wish sometimes that I would shut me up, and because there's so many more interesting things. My friend just got back from Tokyo, and he bought this Seiko Alpinist.
Those are cool.
It's a super cool watch. And really hard to find in just with, you know, sharp lugs and all this. And I thought, holy crap. I mean, this was like their Explorer. It was made for Japanese mountain men, whatever those are. I guess I think they would like carry mail across mountains or something, and then they became like a sports, like a hiking type thing. And it's an incredibly beautiful sector dial cool watch that he got for $700. Yep. So it's, you know, it's still out there.
Yeah. So we're going to start to wind things up here. And to end every show, we like to ask for some sort of cultural recommendation, something people can go to after this. So, Gary, I'm going to make you do something a little self-serving.
Oh, boy.
I realize we've talked a lot about your forthcoming novel, but we haven't actually mentioned the name. So can you mention the name of your novel, give us a little preview, and maybe plug it a little bit? Tell us when it's coming out, how people can get their hands on it.
I'm a big plugger of novels. So the book is Lake Success. My last book was called Little Failure, which was my mom's nickname for me, and that was a memoir. So we thought we'll go from failure to success. And it'll be out September 4th in America, and I think around the same time in the UK.
Okay.
And it's, as I mentioned before, it's a book about a hedge fund guy who goes banana, a watch-loving hedge fund guy who goes crazy, abandons his family, his failing fund, gets on a Greyhound bus. And so the journey throughout America, and especially the southern part of America, is sort of the backbone of the novel. Part of it is set in New York, but part of it is set. And every place he goes, I should mention that when he runs away from his wife, he also takes a rollerboard filled with watches. And each segment of the journey is represented by a different watch. So that may appeal to some watch nerds. And I'll be touring the hell out of this book in across the U.S., most large metros in September. Also, I think late August, I'll be doing London and Edinburgh. And then in October, I think I'll be doing a lot of Canadian cities. So, you know, wherever you are, I hopefully will be.
We'll find a way, whether it's in the show notes here or somewhere else on the website, we'll make sure people can find those dates.
Cool.
Yeah. Jack, what do you recommend people go take a look at?
You know, I just saw Avengers Infinity War.
Okay. No spoilers, please.
And no.
For the 12 movies I haven't seen.
I think pretty much everyone who's going to see that movie has seen it.
Yeah.
But it's all about time. And it's a surprisingly, I don't know, maybe I was bringing a lot of my own preoccupations to the viewing experience, but there was a lot in it about the manipulation of time and about the power of nostalgia and about the desire to, you know, make time stand still in ways that are ultimately not, you know, not tenable. And one of the most powerful objects in the film is actually, you know, an object that's intimately related to the nature of time and the passage of time in this universe and every other universe. And I cried at the end. Okay. Oh my God. So, you know.
That's okay. Amazing. This is the first positive thing I've heard about that movie.
The check cried at the end.
Well, I mean, look, two, no. I mean,
that's the new thing on Rotten Tomatoes. It gets the how Jack fresh, cry. And then did Jack cry?
That's on the marquee.
Jack cried.
Oh my God.
That actually makes me want to see it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of a sucker for operatic comic book treatment of just about anything.
Kel Surprise.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm going to recommend a film also, actually, that I watched on Netflix. It's not new, but I think it recently came to Netflix, and I just watched it last week, which is Finding Vivian Maier.
If
you're not familiar, Vivian Maier is a photographer who worked as a nanny in the Midwest for the second half of the 20th century, and carried a camera around with her everywhere. Shot.
I thought she was in New York.
Was for a brief time. She's from New York, but she worked mostly in the Midwest, in Chicago, actually, mostly.
Yep.
But she took hundreds of thousands of photographs, and an auction picker, basically found boxes of negatives and undeveloped film and photographs in a storage unit, just picking a random box of negatives, and has essentially kind of re-amassed her archive and is selling it. And he is sort of a complicated character who, you know, in some ways you want to like because he's saving this great art, and in some ways comes off as the slimy storage unit picker you would expect him to come off as. And they go back.
I hope
back
he's
and,
not a Hodinkee reader.
I kind of hope he is. Please get in touch if you are.
You jerk.
But they go back and interview all these people who she worked with and try to complete this sort of picture of who she was and why she never showed anyone her photographs.
That's
and
really
it's
cool.
A really interesting portrait of like how we judge people and how That's we really come cool. to conclusions about people. So it's on Netflix. I don't know how much longer it'll be there, but I highly recommend you take a look at it.
That's really interesting. You know, in Russia, there's this concept that some of the best writers, especially during the Soviet times when writing could get you in trouble, were the ones who wrote, this term was vstol, or into the table. The ones who never showed anything was like almost a saintly kind of writer who doesn't need any kind of approbation. So I am not that writer, but I've heard of them.
Yeah. By Gary's books. Great. Well, thank you, Gary, for being here.
Oh,
this is great.
Yeah.
And we're going to have some more conversations with you later this year.
Cool. Yeah.
That'll be good.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah. And thanks, Jack.
Thank you. Been a pleasure, guys.
Thanks again to Gary and to Jack for joining us. This week's episode was produced by Grayson Korhonen and was recorded at Miratone Studios in New York City. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.